I think Washington itself is changing very, very fast. It's becoming a global capital far beyond simply the U.S. government. Another thing that was interesting to me, there are some Asian countries that are Washington-centric and some that are New York-centric. For example, Korea and China are quite Washington-centric. Japan, even though there's the Cherry Blossom Festival, which, of course, reminds a lot of people of the U.S.-Japan relationship, Japan is much more New York-centric. It's interesting to see all of the ways that different people promote their cultures in Washington. The cultural side, I think, is an important part of Trans-Pacific understanding, and I was interested in how all of that happened. Sort of the classical model that we have is that lobbyists are the key people in Washington and in U.S. relations with the Pacific in particular. I found that that has really changed quite a lot recently, that we've moved to think tanks, the internet, the mass media. Those sorts of things are becoming more and more important. Washington is really becoming a global stage, and its relations with Asia and the world move very rapidly.
You have a lot of neat graphics in your book. One of them is a map of the Washington Information Complex, which shows the areas where the embassies are, the think tanks are, mass media, PR firms, multilateral organizations. Describe a little bit about all these different ways that Washington interacts with the world in Asia in particular.
Well, there's so much outside the government, exactly as you've said. There's the International Monetary Fund, there's the World Bank, there's the Inter-American Development Bank that funds Latin America. Even the Asian Development Bank has a big office. Three of the four top think tanks in the world are within about 300 yards of each other on Massachusetts Avenue. Then there's the big lobbying firms, of course, several universities, Johns Hopkins, Georgetown, George Washington. And then the bureaus of a lot of the mass media, as well as the embassies, you know, well over 150 different countries. So it's a tremendous variety, but it goes far, far beyond the U.S. government. And that's one of the main points I was making.
It's almost difficult to comprehend all these different entities interacting and directly engaging other countries. It's amazing that anybody can keep it all straight.
Well, you know, what I really found that was interesting is that even though it's complex, it's having some fairly clear but important effects on world affairs. If we take, for example, our trade policy, we've had large trade imbalances for the last four decades. Yet we have had really quite a mild response to the various trade crises. Also, of course, our alliances, generally speaking, have stayed quite consistent with countries around the region. What's happened outside the government has been relatively stabilizing. Also, we've got a lot of information about what's happening in the world. I think our decision-making generally has, even if occasionally we haven't been as decisive as sometimes people would like to see, it's been quite knowledgeable about how global forces are developing.
With the current policy of a rebalance or a pivot toward Asia, it's interesting that you write with the Washington factor in Asia that it was the hub of the hub-and-spoke security system that dominated international affairs in the Pacific and also Cold War policy. And, and here we come back to this pivot toward Asia and this military focus in the region.
Well, I think what we sometimes don't realize is how important the United States and particularly Washington looms for Asia. In particular, the countries of Asia have been outsiders in the international system generally, but in Washington, which is so multifaceted, has so many approach routes, it's been relatively easy for countries in Asia to become part of the global agenda. So I think the difficulties of access they have in some places, like in Europe or in Russia or Latin America, or even in parts of other Asian countries, it contrasts to Washington, which is pretty open, and if you're savvy and sophisticated, than you can get access on a global agenda through Washington.
That would seem to be what we would want, though, is a lot of open interaction back and forth in that access.
I do think that's right. Sometimes we don't appreciate the value to us of the way that Washington becomes such an important center. Every year we have all the finance ministers, a lot of the top politicians gathering together for the IMF and the World Bank meetings. We've had a global nuclear summit here. We've had the first of the G20 meetings here. And then a lot of people go to school here, or they just come through to visit and to network. Washington is a great place to meet people, to renew contacts, to gain inside information, as well as just talking to the U.S. government.
You also talk about outside of the Beltway, so to speak. Of course, inside of the Beltway is the term for Washington, D.C. proper.
Mm-hmm.
But outside of the Beltway, Asia across America and your chapter, The Changing Calculus, Asians have had a tremendous influence on this country, especially, too, on the West Coast.
Sure. Well, I'm glad that you mentioned that. I think this is something very important that many Americans don't realize, and across Asia, sometimes I think people don't understand how quickly the United States has been changing. Of course, we're a very diverse and dynamic country, I think, because of that diversity. But since 1965, when the Immigration Act was revised, we've seen a large increase in our Asian American population, which is now almost 5% of the total country. And in another 25 years or so, the projections are that it'll be close to 10% of America's population.